Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, the latest chapter, the latest great adventure from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how are we this fine day?
Getting a bit colder, actually. I have a rough phone signal where I live, and I had to go outside last night to call my mother. I always try and call her every evening about bedtime, which for her is about 8:30.
Right.
And I couldn't get a signal in the house, so went outside. Mm. I just stood outside for about 3 minutes, and I was freezing.
Really?
The weather's really changed now, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty glad about that. I have to say that I know that we're really into autumn and heading for winter when I start putting my dressing gown on in the mornings, okay?
You've got a dressing gown?
I've got a dressing gown. Big, big, fluffy, woolly one.
What colour is it?
It's blue and blue stripes, dark blue and light blue stripes, and it's really big, fluffy one. I love it, but I can only wear it in very cold weather. Because I'm so sensitive to heat, I can't stand being hot all the time, you know what I mean? So, but I've worn that for the last 2 days. I only wear it for about the first hour of the day, because I get up at about 5 o'clock, and as soon as light comes up and the world starts getting warm, I have to take my dressing gown off and put on my normal indoor attire. But
which is what do you wear around the house?
Oh, a pair of football shorts and a
it's getting better
and a Bermuda shirt to bring some sort of, you know, gaiety to life, if you see what I mean, you know, a bit of light.
Quite for sore eyes. So when the postman comes, he's treated to this vision of Michael Parry in his football shorts and his Hawaiian shirt.
Well, only if he's peering through the letterbox, because he puts my letters through the letterbox. I don't...
He has to go down and sign for something or something.
Oh, well, yeah, look, when I say my indoor attire, it's perfectly acceptable outdoor attire, you know, very high quality shorts and a shirt. Because that's what I feel more comfortable in. I've told this story before, but many years ago, I have an indoor wardrobe and an outdoor wardrobe, and the outdoor wardrobe never impinges on the indoor wardrobe. So, for instance, when I come in through the front door of my apartment, to my left is my smaller bathroom. It's the one with the bath in it, actually, because my other bathroom is a wet room with a shower in. But that's got a tiled floor. So as I step through the door, I only have to take 2 paces across, you know, a floor mat to my bathroom. It's got a tiled floor, and that's where I've got a seat where I take my shoes off, and I hang my coat on the hook and all that kind of stuff. And then I go back into the apartment, so to speak, into my second room, bedroom, which is also my changing room. And I change out of my outdoor clothes and put them in one wardrobe and into my indoor clothes in the other.
Well, I mean, how the other half live? You know, you've got all this going on. It's strange. I do agree with you. I've always had a thing about taking shoes off at the front door.
Yeah.
I trained my kids to do that very early.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the second thing they always had to do when they came home from school was go straight to the sink and wash their hands.
Yes, absolutely.
So all of these measures put in place since the pandemic outbreak, this is quite normal behaviour for us. We've always done that kind of thing.
Yes,
just normal precautions, I suppose, especially living in London, isn't it?
But yeah.
I'm intrigued by your indoor outfits, I have to say.
Well, no, you see, the thing is, I don't know whether I'm just a bit funny, but if I come in and I, look, supposing I've been out and I've been wearing a pair of chinos and a shirt and maybe a jacket and all that. If I've been sitting on a seat on a tube train or a train or something like that, I don't want to transmit whatever was on that seat and therefore will be on the seat of my trousers to my seats at home, my furniture at home. So I never, ever touch anything in the house that's been touched out of the house, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Absolutely with you on that. The one thing I disagree with is I wouldn't put clothes that I'd worn outside into a wardrobe.
I don't. That's a figure of speech. What I do is everything goes into the linen basket to be washed, okay? The only things I would hang up back in a wardrobe Well, I don't hang anything back up in the wardrobe. I put my coat on the hook, as I say, in my second bathroom. But no, yeah. I don't put anything back into a wardrobe that's been worn. I totally agree with you.
That's a real tick of mine. I never ever put clothes back in the wardrobe that have been worn because, they, as you say, they've been outside and they're covered in stuff, germs. Everything.
Yeah, exactly. Even shirts.
You sound like a right pair of biddies here.
Yeah, we do. Well, no, I think it's only common sense. I mean, you know, if you've worn a shirt all day when you've been out, it's obviously picked up all sorts of stuff from the atmosphere. It's also, you know, you've worn it all day. It's got bits of your skin on it and all that kind of stuff.
Ew. Yeah. Well, gross. Yeah. When I was at school, we used to wear a shirt for 2 or 3 days at a time and not think anything of it.
Yeah.
I find that horribly gross now.
Well, I totally agree, but you had to do what your mum told you, didn't you? You know, it's the way your mum told you. The other thing I thought about this as well, this is really interesting. I can't even remember. I obviously have got two showers. I've got a shower and a bath in both my homes, right? And I know you shower about 2 or 3 times a day sometimes. I never shower more than once a day because I haven't frankly got time. Well, no, that's not true. If I've showered in the morning, gone out, and it's been a hot day, so I will shower when I get back in. But normally speaking, probably just in the mornings. But when I was a kid, we didn't have a shower. And I can't remember how many times or how often or how we got washed each day before going to school. I just can't work it out.
We only washed our faces most days.
Is that right?
It's disgusting now, doesn't it? But I remember that Sunday night was hair washing night.
Right.
So we, and there were four of us. So we'd all kind of queue up, you know, to go in. And we did weird things like sharing bath water and stuff.
Yes, we did that.
Which we would never do now.
No.
But Sunday night was hair washing night, which was a really big deal because with three sisters in the family, we all had long hair. So there was this horrible sort of squealing hair washing session. And then we'd have to sit down in front of the fire and my mother would comb our hair. And of course, it was all tangled and knotty and revolting because we only washed it once a week, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which horrifies me now. So I'm always washing my hair now.
Yeah, no.
We're very different in our habits of hygiene.
I totally agree. But even when I was sort of, you know, even when I was a young reporter, so I was sort of 19 or something, still living at home, I can't did I have a bath every day? I can't remember, honestly.
Because there wasn't the water. There wasn't the money to pay for heating the water, that kind of thing.
Maybe.
We're not in the habit of bathing every day.
No, I think you may well be right. It sounds terrible now, doesn't it? It sounds shocking that. But I tell you what I remember we did have. We had one of those, you know, one of those sort of shower attachments where there's two big suckers and you stick them onto the taps, right?
I remember this. They were sort of a horrible pink calamine colour white.
That's right. And you thought it was so glamorous. You were sitting in the bath and you had an attachment hairspray. Oh, no. I know. Anyway, but there we go.
My favourite house, I had a bidet in one of my houses.
Oh, I've had
a
bidet.
And that is an absolute boon to have a bidet, to be able to wash your little bum, you know, at different times.
Oh, really, Miss Jones? Come on, this is getting a bit intimate, isn't it? Too much information. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, that is useful because otherwise you have to keep having showers. So it's a whole strip off, whereas you can wash your feet in a bidet as well.
Well, I suppose you can.
Very, very useful.
I think they're going out of fashion again now, aren't they? I remember.
I wish they wouldn't. I wish every home would have one because they are tremendously useful things.
I had a house.
In hotels.
Halfway through my career, I bought a what you might call a townhouse now, and it was 3 stories and lovely and 3 bathrooms. Well, it had a downstairs loo and then 2 other bathrooms, you know. And believe it or not, I did have an olive green bathroom suite, you know, the ones that you now see in sort of 30-year-old.
Oh, I thought you mean avocado.
Avocado, yeah.
Yeah, oh my God, weren't they horrible?
Yeah, well, I thought they were quite glamorous in those days.
We did. Mum and Dad had a bungalow down at Broadstairs, a little holiday place.
Yeah.
And the bathrooms there were avocado. Yeah. And we thought we were the bee's knees because we had this.
Yes.
And now, I mean, if you've got anything other than white, forget it.
Yes, no, I totally agree. Now then, Miss Jones, you and I have seen a lot of editors come and go in Fleet Street, haven't we? And the thing that always used to amaze me was the price of failure in Fleet Street. And the reason I bring this up is because Steve Bruce, now it's 10 days since he left Newcastle, but he left with an £8 million cheque. And he's given the first sort of real interviews about how he felt about it all. And, you know, it's difficult to feel sorry for somebody who's picked up £8 million in payoffs. And it made me think, you know, Steve Bruce, the editor in Fleet Street, sometimes you're better off failing than you are winning.
Well, Jose Mourinho is another example, isn't he? And
I think Jose's made about 20 million quid in payoffs.
Yeah, it's another form of failing upwards, I think. Yeah. I knew this American guy for years. He's moved back to Texas now.
Right.
But he made a lucrative career out of failing miserably at big, big jobs and then suing the companies he worked for afterwards to increase his payoff by several more million.
Yeah.
I think there's a knack to it, but I wish I knew what it was.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It used to horrify me in Fleet Street, where there I was, the hardworking news editor, you know, in there from 6:30 in the morning till 8 or 9 o'clock at night, 6 days a week, and all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, a new executive editor would join the paper and start trying to interfere at. In the morning conference and the afternoon conference, but didn't do anything in between, literally, just didn't do anything, just terribly critical at times, but didn't do anything. And these people were always an ex-friend of the editor, somebody he'd worked with in the past, just appointing them, putting them on the gravy train. When Sir Nick Lloyd was my editor at The Express, all of a sudden a guy called Bernard Shrimsley turned up, okay? And Shrimsley was a bit of a Fleet Street legend. He'd been the editor of The Sun and The News of the World, but he was terribly sophisticated. He was very well-spoken. He was kind of as far away from the tabloid market as you could imagine. He should have been editing The Times or something like that. But, he brought real style to the occasion. And Bernard used to sit around all day doing nothing until afternoon conference and then start making all sorts of critical comments about the news list and all that kind of stuff. I used to hate him and I used to make it absolutely clear I hated him, right? And I used to, snap back at him in conference and show utter contempt for him because he was just a hanger-on.
Well, that's not very nice, Michael.
Well, he was just a hanger-on. And it took me ages to work out why he was there. And in fact, he was there because when Nick worked for News International, Nick was... the editor of the News of the World, Bernard was a big shot in that group. And Nick was just helping Bernard when Bernard lost his last job and thought, I tell you what, I'll take him on board here. He's sadly died now. And we did make it up before the end, actually. I saw him when he was about 78 at some function or some do or something. And we got on quite well. But I hate those peoples. But the point of my story is him and his brother Anthony Shrimsley, who was the first and only editor of the ill-fated magazine Now. Do you remember it? It lasted 5 days. It lasted exactly 5 days. All these highfalutin journalists in Fleet Street all quit their well-paid jobs on, established titles like The Times and The Guardian and all that, went to work for Now. It literally lasted, it was Jimmy Goldsmith, the financier who'd funded it. It lasted 5 days and they were all out of work, but they all picked up big payoffs. But so Anthony Shrimsley picked up the biggest payoff, the editor, and I think he got two other payoffs. Bernard got about three. They picked up well over a million, in payoffs. And I always thought to myself, if only I'd been a better political operator in the office. Office politics gets you everywhere, whereas actually being frank and forthright and hardworking often doesn't.
It's so true, isn't it? And of course, so many of them ended up at the graveyard of Fleet Street, which was the Daily Mail.
Yes,
so
that's right.
People like Robin Esser, they got snapped up and ended their days at the Mail because the Mail didn't want them wielding their influence anywhere else.
Yeah, no.
So they brought them in and gave them nothing to do rather than have them floating around out there.
No, that's absolutely true. Robin Esser, for the benefit of our millions of listeners, was editor of the Sunday Express. And you're right, when he got the boot, he turned up across the road at the Daily Mail. Same thing happened to Brian Vine. Brian Vine was the doyen of the New York Press Corps as bureau chief of the Daily Express. And funny enough, I was sent over to replace him because he'd done his time and he'd become lazy and a bit pompous about his role. So Larry Lamb sacked him. Put me in the place. Brian came back, and lo and behold, you're absolutely right. All of a sudden, he was taken on by the Daily Mail, who was then being run by Paul Dacre. The Sunday Express story is very funny. I'm not sure if I've told you this, but a guy called Alan Frame was the features editor on the Express.
I saw him the other day. He rocked up at Paul Callan's memorial service.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Well, he came up and introduced himself. He said, "Do you remember me?"
Yeah.
And that was nice to see him again, actually. Yeah. He gave one of the readings.
Oh, well, that's lovely. Yeah, he's a lovely fella, Alan Frame, really. A real gentleman, a real gentleman sort of journalist and terribly polite and all that kind of stuff. And he was the features editor of the Express. And he'd had a meeting with the chairman, a guy called Lord somebody or other. I can't remember his name now. There's so many Lords in Fleet Street. And came away from the meeting in the belief that he was going to be appointed the new editor of the Sunday Express in the same group, obviously. So he took everybody down to the pub, and he took over one corner of the pub, the Popinjay in Fleet Street, drinks all round, and fantastic, my breakthrough, first editor's job in Fleet Street and all that. And after about 2 hours, suddenly the other guy, Robin Esser, came in with a couple of friends, went to the other end of the pub, and they started buying loads of drinks. And somebody said, "What are you celebrating?" And Robin Esser said, "I've just been made the editor of the Sunday Express." And it's incredible. There were two blokes in the same pub celebrating being made editor of the Sunday Express. And sure enough, Alan Frame went back upstairs to see the chairman, who'd gone home, but was told by the managing director, "Oh, no, I think there's been a misunderstanding. Robin's the new editor of the Sunday Express." Talk about deflated.
Oh, did they ever explain what happened there then?
Well, that was Fleet Street in those days, wasn't it? Nobody knew what was going on. Everybody assumed things. Nobody could get a straight answer from management. It was just madness. But anyway, there we go.
There was even a pub. There was a pub opposite the entrance of the Mirror group used to be.
Yeah.
I forget the actual name of the pub, but it was known as the Stab.
Stab in the back, yeah.
Because that's where editors used to take journalists to fire them.
That's right. It's called the White Hart.
That was a little bit before my time, but I went in there with my dad a few times.
When
I was still at school, actually, I used to go half terms and holidays to sit around with my dad in the office.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
I really wanted to be a journalist.
I know, it's fantastic. And you sent me a fantastic picture the other day of the Daily Express in its heyday in Fleet Street. In fact, I think that was even before its heyday. It looked to me from the vehicles and the lettering on the building that was probably in the sort of 1930s
it was when Amy Johnson completed her, was it Around the World flight?
Yes, that's right. Yes,
solo flight. And hundreds and thousands of people turned up in Fleet Street.
Yeah.
Because didn't they, she arrived in a great big Rolls Royce
outside the
Daily Express building.
That's right. It was probably sponsored by Beaverbrook, who owned the Daily Express. He bought it in the 1930s. The heyday of the newspapers was 1964, when both the Express and the Mirror registered sales of 4 million a day. It was absolutely unbelievable. It was the only form of communication in those days, of course. There was no real...
90% of news and information reached the public via newspapers.
Yes, that's right.
This was pre-internet, pre-social media, pre-24/7 television.
Yeah.
Nowadays, people have so many other ways of accessing news, especially breaking news, rolling news.
That's right.
Nobody looks to a newspaper for that kind of thing anymore. And the newspapers are following the news now.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And those respective circulations are now down to about 250,000 each, believe it or not. And they'll soon go out of business because A, women don't buy newspapers, B, young people don't buy newspapers, and C, older people just don't see any worth in newspapers anymore. Even if you don't go seeking information, even if you're not active on your laptop all day, it's all around you all the time. Therefore, by word of mouth, news is now generated because everybody else is finding out what's going on. But anyway, there we are.
I'll tell you one thing. My children, who are, all in their 20s, they're very aware of what's going on. I can never tell them anything that they don't already know about.
Yeah.
So, for example, with this new horrible thing that's been going on in clubs of girls being spiked.
Oh, terrible.
Having needles stuck in their thigh or whatever.
Yes.
By some bloke who's out to have sex with them.
Yeah.
And I was quite concerned about this. I heard a piece on Jeremy Vine's show about it. And immediately I ring up the girls and say, "Have you heard about this?" And go, "Oh, yeah. Mm. Known about that for ages." They're always ahead of the game with me. I can never tell them anything newsworthy.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Now, just to our millions of listeners, sorry, this has been a bit of a newspaper fest, but we do get lots of responses to all the podcasts, and people seem to like the old Fleet Street story. So, just got one more here, but this is a bit juicier, and it's newspaper from Germany, and that is that the editor of Europe's biggest sailing daily, which is Bild, in Germany, know the paper very well indeed, the editor's been sacked because he's been found having a scandalous affair with a trainee journalist. My goodness me, could you believe that ever happened in the newspaper world, Miss Jones?
Oh, God, yeah, pull the other one. Of course, it happened so much during our day, but it bloody well shouldn't. And quite right that he's been fired. Anyone in a position of power must keep their distance from powerless trainees. Mm. I mean, it's rule number one, isn't it, really? Having said that, I had experience of this. I'm sure I've told you about it years ago.
Yep.
And I'm not going to name the editor. Mm. But I was actually pursued by an editor who got me to go around to his house. Mm. We were going to some event and I had to go around and pick him up. And I was driving my dad's car. Mm. And it was a Ford Capri. And I remember going to park it in that car park underneath the Royal Garden Hotel, which has like a spiral staircase going down. Yeah. Where you drive the car down this spiral.
That's right.
And of course, I couldn't manage it very well because I was quite a new driver.
Yeah.
And I remember scraping the car all along the wall down this
spiral. You would have done, yeah. The wheels as well, the concrete blocks. Yeah. No, I remember.
When I got round to his house, he answered the door wearing a mini dressing gown, speaking of dressing gowns.
Yeah.
And he was holding a bottle of champagne and a tea towel and handing them out to me. You can imagine what he had in mind.
Oh, dear. That's disgusting, isn't it? I mean, look, all that sort of thing went on. But I can't understand how any bloke could do that, try and impose himself upon a young woman, particularly if he's in a position of power. I mean, look, it's never anything that ever occurred to me. But quite apart from anything else, the opening yourself up to that sort of blackmail, I think, is just very, very stupid, as well as horribly sort of creepy. You know what I mean?
On the other hand, you had your share of secretaries, didn't you? And they must have been quite young ladies at the time.
Yeah, but they had, you know, there was nothing improper about it. They didn't work direct. I never had an affair with a secretary who worked in my department. Okay. Never.
Did you not? Oh, okay.
No.
I thought you had the girls on the floor, as it were.
No. I always made up.
Not a euphemism.
Yes. Thank you, Miss Jones. Once again. But I do know one Fleet Street editor who used to constantly boast that he'd had sex with at least half a dozen young female journalists. And when I put it to him, I thought, aren't you holding yourself up to ransom there? Supposing they suddenly start getting threatening, suddenly threaten to tell your wife and all that. He said, no, it doesn't work like that. He said, it's the other way around. He said, they are frightened for their jobs and I'm in charge of their careers. They do anything to upset me, they're out the door. And so what if they go around telling people that, you know, I've been giving them one? Nobody's going to believe them anyway.
That is an abuse of power. That's horrible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, there have been some quite large settlements over the years involving sort of hush money, which are not widely known to the public. And I'm talking about large payments from females complaining about the behaviour of their bosses. But look, that's for another day. The guy...
I'll tell you one thing. There's a, well, former record company owner, household name, who made a point of having sex with every single girl he employed. So they'd come for the interviews and he would always try them out, as it were, before he gave them the job.
Good God.
And it was well known that every single female who worked for that organisation had been to bed with him.
Good God. That was a record company, you say?
Yeah, you'd know who I meant, and I'm not going to say it.
No, well, obviously. But, you see, I wouldn't have the confidence, the audacity, the cheek, or even the chutzpah to do that sort of thing. It's never occurred to me, honestly. Maybe I don't have enough confidence around women or something like that. But anyway, getting back to...
I mean, not being rude, but if you looked like him, you know, sort of a very classically attractive man.
Right.
And I'm not saying that you're not, this is a person who could, you know, double as a model in his day.
Mm.
I suppose there's a certain arrogance that comes with that. And you're certainly not an arrogant person.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you, Miss Jones. The build editor I'm talking about is a guy called Julian Reichelt. And he just, you know, he's apologised and said, yeah, I suppose it was a little bit out of order. But, you know, a tale of the times, I think. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Well, a lot of newspaper talk there, Leslie Ann, but, of course, other things happen in life. Tell you whose birthday is today as we're recording, Richard Dreyfuss, and he's 73. I can only ever remember Richard Dreyfuss in one film, and that's Jaws. But everybody.
Well, I was going to say Jaws. I can't think of him in anything else either.
No, exactly. But, you know, I've just been reading some of the tributes to him on his birthday, saying, you know, a classic actor, you know, a man of great talent and all that kind of stuff. Some of these actors are, wow, wasn't that a terrible story last week, by the way, about the shooting on the film set, you know, Alec Baldwin.
Oh, my God. I nearly, well, I won't say I nearly died when I read it, but I was completely shocked. Yeah. How can that happen in this day and age? How can a stunt gun, I think is what it was, how can that go off at such close proximity and kill a member of the crew?
Yeah, I know. I totally agree. And they still haven't found out. It's over a week now. And they still haven't found out what went wrong. And, you know, the cinematographer, the lady who runs all the cameras and all that, she lost her life, obviously. Terrible.
She was only 42. And shocking, shocking story.
Yeah.
He's had a lot of bad luck lately, hasn't he, with all that scandal about his wife pretending to be Spanish.
Yeah.
And such a weird story. There was, I'm sure there's more to that. It'll come out.
I'm sure there is. Was he and Kim Basinger a big number at one time?
Baldwin. I believe they were an item, yes.
Say nighty night and kiss me. That was Kim Basinger's song in a film she made. I can't remember.
Dream a Little Dream of Me, that's a Mamas and a Papas song.
Yeah, that's right. It is a Mamas and Papas song. But I remember seeing her in a film and that was the background music. And I thought, A, Kim Basinger was very, very beautiful. And that was just a beautiful song written by Mama Cass, I suppose, because she was an interesting character. She was about sort of 20 stone, wasn't she? And nobody's getting fat except Mama Cass. But such a gifted musician. She wrote all those brilliant Mamas and Papas songs, didn't she?
She and John Phillips, who was kind of the leader of the band, and she died in the same Mayfair flat as Keith Moon of The Who, the drummer.
Good God, did she? Amazing. Yeah. Good.
Yeah, there's a flat with a lot of history. I think that, and I might be wrong about this, I think that Harry Nilsson died in the same flat.
Good God.
One of those weird sort of rock and roll stories.
Yeah, very.
A bit like 27 Club, you know, when a whole bunch of rock stars at the age of 27.
Yeah.
So there was Brian Jones, Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, somebody else. Amy Winehouse was also 27. So there was this thing called the 27 Club.
Mm.
I made a film about it once with Simon Napier-Bell.
Absolutely shocking. Right, talking about flats in London then, that takes us smoothly on to
Nice segue.
Paul McCartney. Because, look, you know, trillions of words have been written about Paul McCartney and the Beatles, and now it's all about the new Paul McCartney book, Lyrics. And I've read the excerpts from that, and I find it utterly fascinating, which we said in last week's podcast. But since then, I've come across a piece which tells about the influence of the Asher family on Paul McCartney. Now, everybody knew that he lived in the flat just off Oxford Street, didn't he, with the Asher family? Was it?
So they lived actually on Harley Street. His father was a consultant at Middlesex Hospital.
Yes, amazing. And her mother, Jane Asher's mother, was a musical teacher at the Royal Academy of Music and taught George Martin, the legendary producer of the Beatles songs, taught George Martin how to play the oboe when he was a student. Talk about coincidence.
Well, not only that, but Jane Asher's brother was Peter Asher, who made his name as part of Peter and Gordon.
Please lock me away and don't allow the day here inside where I hide in my loneliness. You're absolutely right.
Paul World Without Love. That was quite a good rendition, actually. Then Peter went on to discover and make a global star of James Taylor.
Did he? Good God. And it's all down to Paul McCartney. Apparently, Jane Asher's mother also taught Paul McCartney how to play the recorder, which he used on a couple of Beatles tracks. And her influence on him was enormous because she was a classical musician. Absolutely wonderful. I'll tell you a little story which I can relate to there. When I was writing a book for a footballer, I was ghostwriting it. Went to see the publishers, you know, I'd done another couple of chapters or something like that. And as I was sitting in this room with the editor of the book, another guy came in and said, "Oh, hi, Mike, great, very nice to meet you, you know, big fan of yours, listen to you on the radio all the time," that kind of stuff. And I said, "Yeah, great." And the guy sitting opposite me was called Rory Scarfe, okay? And he was the editor.
Great name, Rory Scarfe.
Yeah, Rory Scarfe, yeah. Yeah.
That is such a classic cartoon name, isn't it?
Rory Scarfe, I suppose it is, yeah.
I bet his dad is Gerald Scarfe, Jane Asher went on to marry.
His dad was Gerald Scarfe, who married Jane Asher, and Rory, who I was sitting opposite, was the son of Jane Asher and Gerald Scarfe. And the most amazing link, you know, tenuous link to the Beatles. And do you know what I said? When I found out that he was the son of Jane Asher, I said instinctively, good God. I said, so actually, you could have been Paul McCartney's son. What a terrible thing to say to somebody whose father is not Paul McCartney.
Well, it is a bit insensitive, Mike, yeah.
Yeah.
But Jane Asher, she inspired loads of songs. I mean, All My Loving, one of my favourite Beatles hits, yeah. And I Love Her. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Fabulous little ballad. I Want to Hold Your Hand was even
I Want to Hold Your Hand, that's right. Yeah.
By
yeah.
her. And Every Little Thing, Another Girl. Mm-hmm. She was only 17 yeah. when they met, and she was already a successful actress.
Yes, that's right.
I always thought it was such a shame that they broke up. But if you think about it, you've got two burgeoning careers in two young people.
Yes.
Like that. Taking them apart on tour, all over the world, in his case, certainly. And they just, it was a bit doomed, wasn't it? They yeah. didn't get enough time together,
yeah.
I suppose, to develop the relationship.
I just wonder what the living arrangements were in the flat in Harley Street, because, as you say, she was 17.
Well, it was a house. It wasn't a flat. It was a house.
Yeah, big house.
And so they had the music room was in the basement. There was a piano down there.
Yeah.
And Paul used to play that piano. Mm. In fact, the rudiments of yesterday were created on that piano, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's
and then
right.
he took it round. He had a friend called Al McCogan, yeah. who John Lennon was having an affair with, actually.
That's right, yeah.
This all came out years later. And the original title of that song was Scrambled Eggs.
Mm, that's right.
Scrambled Eggs, Baby, I Love Your Legs.
That's right, yeah, I know. Fantastic.
They used to have to fit lyrics to the tune before they actually wrote the proper lyrics, just something that scanned properly.
Definitely. Let's come forward a few generations, maybe three or four. Dua Lipa might now be our Eurovision Song Contest entrant next year. For the first time in like 20 or 30 years, we're going to start taking it seriously again. Why are people now taking the Eurovision Song Contest seriously?
We've always taken it seriously. This is not the first time that we've sent a well-known artist.
Yeah.
Katrina and the Waves won it for us.
Oh, that was 25 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, remember the days when we used to send people like Cliff Richard, Olivia,
well,
Rogers, yeah. Lulu. So yeah. we've always sent, or in recent years we haven't sent, but there have been years when we've sent well-known artists. Mm. Now, this is missing the point. This is a song contest. It's about the song that is supposed to be the best song that will represent Europe in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about well-known artists.
Yeah.
So I don't know why this is suddenly coming up again. The other thing is that some people are even complaining about Graham Norton and saying he's the wrong person to front it.
Yeah.
They are missing the point because only UK viewers are exposed to Graham Norton's commentary. That doesn't go all over Europe. I think a lot of these people think that he does.
Yeah.
But no, that's only for our audience, our domestic audience,
right,
here.
Right.
So leave Graham Norton out of it. He's doing a fine job.
Yeah.
But I just think there is resentment towards Great Britain, towards the UK.
Oh, there is. That's what I'm saying.
For having been the dominant force in popular music in the world for 60 years.
It's true.
And they don't want that. They want to kick us out. So this is their one opportunity in the year when they can say, actually, they're not that good. Look, we can produce something Eurovision winning that's far superior to anything they can do.
Yeah.
It's not the case.
Yeah.
You only have to look at our musical history.
No.
So I think give it a rest, really. Take Eurovision with a pinch of salt. Mm. I don't even watch it.
Well,
I don't even care who wins.
That's what I'm saying. By sending our top artist, like Dua Lipa, who I understand is very good. I've never heard one of her records. But
she's okay. Yeah, I mean, she's to me, she's nothing special.
Yeah, right. Okay. As you say, but I agree with you. I think we should just ignore it. But anyway, there we are. I saw a letter in a national newspaper this week from somebody who's just a member of the public called David Morgan. But he was complaining about the wokeness of the modern Church of England. And I thought that might be something that resonated with you, Miss Jones, you being a church warden at one of the country's most famous churches, St Bride's in Fleet Street.
It's a very traditional church, St Bride's. And this hasn't really troubled us to this point.
Mm-hmm.
We are all doing courses all the time for safeguarding and that kind of thing, because things will arise.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got an older congregation. We do have a Sunday school. Mm-hmm. So there are young people coming through the system, as it were, for want of a better phrase. Mm. But the woke scenario hasn't troubled us too much to this point.
Yeah, but on the broader aspects of the Church of England, you're worried about it. I see the Archbishop of Canterbury pontificating on sort of political matters all the time and wonder why.
I'm not worried, no. I do think there is a degree of radicalization of young people. Mm. I use that word deliberately because I do compare wokeism to religious radicalization. I think it's a very dangerous thing. It's going too far. Mm-hmm. We are bending over backwards to accommodate views that may not necessarily stand the test of time, mm-hmm. especially the gender issue. I think we are in danger of seeing it go too far, and there does need to be more sensible discussion on this subject at a certain level, because it's all a bit hysterical at the moment. Yeah. Throughout history, we've seen this, haven't we? Mm. Things do tend to be the latest thing that erupts, that everybody is so worried about and so fearful, but things will calm down.
Yeah, well,
so for that reason, I'm not worried.
I hope so. Talking about calming down, are you a big fan of Fisherman's Friends?
Oh, no, I hate those things.
Really?
Who ever wants to put one of those in their mouth?
Well, you say that, but I can tell you something. Millions of people around the world do. And the reason I bring this up is, you know how much I admire success. I like successful people. I like rich people if they're self-made, because if they've made themselves a big fortune, they must have a big personality and big talent, big character. And so I read the story about the lady who made Fisherman's Friend, the cough suite, a very, very hot burning cough suite. She made it world famous and made it a worldwide product. Her will was published just this week, and she left £41 million. And she started off as a secretary. That is truly a truly great story of success over the years.
What's her name?
Right. Her name is Doreen Lofthouse. OK. She continued a lifetime of philanthropy by bequeathing most of her fortune of £41 million to tragedy. She started off as a secretary in the office of a little chemist's company. And within this chemist's company, they made these sweets for fishermen, because this is all happening in Fleetwood, you know, which is a fishing port on the north, south, east, west coast. And the local chemist used to make these hot sweets because fishermen would come back from, you know, terribly cold and savage days at sea, and their throats would be full of salt and all that kind of stuff. So the local chemist made this this sweet from eucalyptus and menthol. Now, in 1963, this lady joined the company and bit by bit slowly took over the operation of the Fisherman's Friends. In the end, it was being exported to 120 countries around the world. I just love stories like that.
It's a great story, yeah. Good for her. No, they're horrible things, though. I have had them a couple of times in my life, and I there are better things, you know. Is it Halls or Howells that make, they make sort of...
Oh, Halls Menthol, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I like those ones better.
Yeah, well, I always have a packet of Strepsils, because when you're in my business, and sometimes I'd be talking up to 4 or 5 hours a day, your voice does start to go, and your voice is your fortune. If your voice goes, you've had it. So I always carry a packet of Strepsils around with me, honey-flavoured ones or cherry-flavoured ones, and I do find them very effective. You know, you take these things with a pinch of salt, but I find those things very effective indeed. I'm going to sing you a song. Sorry,
the basic thing of just a little slice of lemon and a spoonful of honey in some hot water, that'll do the job as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. I remember once, right, I was signed up to do the voiceover for a series of football adverts prior to a big international tournament. And let me think. I'm thinking this is perhaps about 8 years ago. So it might have been the 2012 World Cup or something like that, okay? But I was doing the voiceovers for the betting company's adverts throughout the 3 or 4 weeks of the World Cup. And I had to turn up at a studio in Soho. I was getting paid a lot of money. I was getting paid £15,000, right, for 3 hours' work, actually, to voice over.
Money for old rope.
Say again?
I didn't mean it.
What did you say?
Money for old rope.
It was, actually, to be honest. But those are the sort of fees you can get paid on these one-offs, you know, and who's going to turn that down? Anyway, I can't remember what I'd been doing at the weekend, but it was something excessive. And so I turned up in Soho on Monday morning, and to my horror, my voice had almost completely gone. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, I don't know what I'd been doing. I had, when I say to excess, I mean, I hadn't, I look after myself. If I've got a job on Monday morning, you won't find me going mad on Sunday afternoon. And for that, for some reason that morning, I wasn't doing radio. I don't know why. But I got it, and my voice had just completely gone. So I didn't, I thought they were going to tell me to stand down because the voice. Anyway, this guy who ran the studios, he must have had a lot of experience of this. He went off and he boiled up. You're absolutely right. Honey, lemon, a spot of cinnamon or something like that, stirred it all up and said, here, take a few swigs of this. And slowly, after about 10 or 15 minutes, my voice got better. And by having a series of breaks after every half hour, we got through it. And I was so relieved because when you lose a job like that, it's a hammer blow.
Yeah, your larynx gets a bit raspy.
It does, yeah.
The vocal cords do get worn out.
Yeah.
I've been through a lot of this with my son because all the singing that he does.
Oh, right, okay, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, paracetamol is a good one as well because it's just something that will ease the pain. And you tend to hold back with your voice. If it hurts to speak, you're holding back and you need to relieve yourself of that pain and soothe the raspiness as well.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right. Now, I'm going to sing your song as I threatened to a few seconds ago. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Who's that?
That's Manfred Mann.
That's right, yeah.
From way back.
And
have you heard of Tom McGuinness?
Who?
Tom McGuinness.
Tom McGuinness? I'm not sure. No, who's he?
So Tom McGuinness is one of the members of Manfred Mann. He's still going. He's a great friend of mine.
Oh, right.
Manfred Mann himself was the keyboardist in the group.
That's actually right.
And the group was named after him.
But he was the singer as well, wasn't he?
So Paul Jones and Mike Darbo were singers.
That's right, they were. You're absolutely right. Yeah, Paul Darbo and Mike.
I tell you my favourite number of theirs.
Yes.
It's a song that you don't hear very much on the radio anymore.
Do-a-diddy-diddy-dum-diddy-doo. That was another one of theirs.
Bad, but I tell you the one I love. Was Pretty Flamingo.
Oh, yeah. Da 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 da. Pretty Flamingo.
And they did The Mighty Quinn, didn't they, of course?
Yeah, come on without, come on within. You won't see nothing like The Mighty Quinn. I used to
work. You're on form today, Mike. I am on good form, yeah.
I used to work with an ex-footballer, a really nice chap called Mickey Quinn, okay? Mickey was a Scouser, born and brought up, Liverpool fan and all that. But he played for... he was quite successful wherever he went. He scored lots of goals, but he was like a Peter Crouch. He only seemed to have a very sort of short lifespan at each club, and then he'd move on to another club and then score another load of goals and then move on to another club. But one of the clubs he played for was Newcastle United. Away the lads, Newcastle. And he was very popular up there. So I've seen him, you know, on the telly a bit over the last 2 or 3 weeks because of the Saudi takeover at Newcastle. But the point I'm making is that the obvious song to sing when Mickey Quinn was scoring goals was, you know, come on without, come on within. You won't see nothing like that, Mickey Quinn. You know.
Yeah, great. I knew that was coming, yeah. On the football score here as well,
yeah.
Did you see that last week Arsenal signed their very first four-year-old?
No, I didn't see that, no.
Astonishing story. I thought it was April the 1st. I checked the date on the on the top of the screen there to begin with.
Yeah.
But it's some little boy who'd been playing out, you know, in the park with his similarly aged chums on Saturday mornings and so on. Yeah. And some scout has come along and picked up this four-year-old. I thought, this is astonishing.
It is astonishing. I mean,
they can't start training that kid for at least another 6 years, I wouldn't have thought.
It just shows you how competitive it is these days. The chances of that kid making it as a professional footballer are about 1 in 1,000. They go around signing all kids all over the place, all the academies, and the ones who get through it. It's much more than 1 in 1,000, actually. It's about 1 in 10,000. Most don't survive, you know, get past 12 years of age at the academy, and then 15 or 16, another two-thirds disappear, and then up to about 18, another 50% of them disappear. It's a ruthless, ruthless business, football. They think nothing of telling you it's all over and all your dreams are shattered. And that's why you've got to so admire those who get through. A great mate of mine in football was Joe Cole, and still is, but Joe doesn't play football anymore. But, I mean, he was a prodigy from the age of about 8 or 9 because he could he could do with a football what a, you know, what a juggler could do with a load of balls in his hand. You know what I mean? He had just genius talent, and he was picked out very early on. But during the course of his association with football clubs, everybody was after him. He said he saw thousands and thousands of boys come into the training scheme last 3 months and be pitched out again.
It's such a shame to be branded a failure.
Yes.
At such a young age.
Yes.
Because where do you go from there? It's a bit like child stars in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's
right. And they're sort of thrown on the scrap heap. They get some big series on TV and they're a big star for a moment.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they become a young teenager.
Yeah.
No. And they're not wanted anymore. And they get into drugs and alcohol and all kinds. And lots of them do go off the rails.
Yeah.
Years ago, I don't know if I told you this, when my eldest was about three.
Yeah.
And I was living in Los Angeles at that point, and I was staying at the Sunset Marquee, which was a sort of residential hotel, somewhere that you stayed sort of for long periods.
Yeah, sort of long term, yeah.
Yeah. And playing with her in the garden, and this guy came up who I didn't know, and he said, and I was typing away some story or other, sitting at a table, and she was playing.
Mm.
And he said, drop your typewriter in the toilet. You're looking at $1 million. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, your kid. She has to come down the studio, do a screen test.
Mm.
And they wanted her to test for Macaulay Culkin's little cousin, English cousin, in Home Alone 3.
Good God.
And I ummed and awed about it. And I thought through all the scenarios and I just thought, I don't want that life for her.
Yeah.
When she's five, I want to go back to England and put her in a nice little English school and bring her up with an English accent and have just a nice little English girl. I didn't want to sell my kid to Hollywood.
Golly, that's an amazing story. And do you ever look back and think she could have been worth millions now? She could be a household name. Her face could have been on the billboards up and down Hollywood Boulevard.
No, because her life would have been destroyed. She was too young for it and too nice. And she's the most delightful person today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes she says to me, oh, Mommy, you should let me do that.
I was going to say, did you ever tell her that, the lost opportunity?
Yeah, I wrote about it, actually, in the Mail on Sunday a few years ago.
Right.
I got a huge response to it because most people said what you've just said. Mm. Actually, you stole her opportunity.
Yeah.
You should have given her that. I disagree. She had a lovely childhood in obscurity, and she's a really nice person today.
I mean, look, you're in the know and you've worked these things out. How serious was this guy? He wasn't just some sort of, tosser who walks around parks in Los Angeles trying to pretend to be a film agent, was he?
Oh, no, we did the screen test. We actually went
to
the studio and we did the screen test and watched the footage, and she was astonishing. You know, there is a thing where the camera, the screen, picks out something of a person that you don't see by looking at them.
Right.
There is some quality that is picked up through the lens.
Really?
And it's indefinable, but she certainly had it.
Yeah.
There was a translucence about her.
Mm.
She looked like Snow White, with the perfect white skin and the black hair and the dark eyes.
Yeah.
It was just very special, and it frightened me.
Yeah, golly. Well, it's an amazing story, Miss Jones. Thank you for sharing that with us. Look, just before we go, by the way, I think Paul Campagene is a friend of yours, isn't he?
He's a very good friend.
Very good friend, that's right, yeah. And he's been writing recently about Elton John, 6 decades, and the old crocodile still rocking. But he reveals a story about how he met Elton John, and it's something you and I really, really can recognize. He was a student at Oxford when he went to a concert at the Royal Festival Hall, Bee Gees concert, okay? And he noticed Elton John in the VIP area in the crowd. So he followed him into the gents' loo when he saw Elton John moving there. And he was working part-time for the American magazine Rolling Stone and wanted to get his first big scoop by getting an interview with Elton John. And so he said to Elton John at the appropriate moment, please, will you talk to me? I'm a student and all that. And Elton John very politely said, you'll have to talk to my agent, and told him the number. But because of his persistence, a week later, he got an interview with Elton John. And that's a great, great story of the way some of us start in the business, isn't it?
It's classic, yeah. It's one of those claims to fame. People I have peed next to.
Yes.
So my son loves to go around telling the story that we were at the Latchmere a few years ago for a showcase. And my son went...
Wait, what's the Latchmere?
Latchmere is a little theatre pub in Battersea.
Right, yeah.
And my son wandered into the gents during the interval and stood in the stool having a pee, as you do, and glanced to his left, and there was Hugh Grant.
Oh, right.
So he came out and said, "This is my claim to fame, Mama. You know, I've had a pee next to Hugh Grant." I think it's a sort of man thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
A woman would never say that.
Yeah, well, you can't see through a cubicle wall, can you?
Yeah, except you can hear.
Yes, yeah.
And it's something I've always objected to about ladies' toilets, is they go to all the lengths of making these cubicles so you've got a bit of privacy, but there's a big gap underneath the space between, you know, the little wall, the wall et between the two cubicles, as it were.
Yeah.
There's a big space over the top. You can hear absolutely everything that's going on.
Yes.
And it just... doesn't seem very nice to me. I like privacy. I like going around places, especially in London, where, you know, where you can have a decent pee in private. And there is a hotel called the Ham Yard Hotel. There used to be a famous club there in the 50s and 60s. Forget the name of it, because I wasn't born then.
And where
is it? The Ham Yard Hotel, just in Ham Yard in Soho. And they have proper toilets in there, which have got brick walls between the cubicles.
Sure.
So you have complete privacy, and that's the one for me.
Too much information there for me, Miss Jones, but I'm like you. Sometimes I'd rather go home rather than use public loos or the loos in establishments which I don't think are very upmarket. But there we are. That's for
final question for you. Have you ever peed in a hole in the ground?
Oh, goodness, Miss Jones. I think we have
in France, I mean, in France.
No, I haven't.
Sometimes you'd go to a restaurant, a really nice French restaurant, and then you'd ask to use the bathroom, and they'd direct you down this little spiral staircase, and you'd get down into this kind of cubicle, and there would be a hole in the ground, not joking, with a drain underneath it, and two sort of metal foot plates, one either side.
Oh, my
God. And the idea was that you put your feet on the foot plates and you squat.
Thank you very much.
That was common in Paris when I was a student there.
Well, it's never happened in where I've been to in Paris, but then again, like nice hotels.
You only go to upmarket, posh places.
Certainly do, indeed. Right. Okay, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed for that ablutionary, lesson.
Ablutionary, I love it,
In life. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much for having joined us today. And thank you, Miss Jones, for joining me. And, folks, we'll be back with you in another week's time. Until then, stay safe. I've got a dressing gown. Big, big, fluffy, woolly one.
What colour is it?
It's blue and blue stripes. Dark blue and light blue stripes. And it's really big, fluffy one. I love it. But I can only wear it in very cold weather. Because I'm so sensitive to heat, I can't stand being hot all the time. You know what I mean? But I've worn that for the last 2 days. I only wear it for about first hour of the day because I get up at about 5 o'clock. And as soon as light comes up and the world starts getting warm, I have to take my dressing gown off and put on my normal indoor attire.
What do you wear around the house?
Oh, a pair of football shorts and a
it's getting better
and a Bermuda shirt to bring some sort of, you know, gaiety to life, if you see what I mean, you know, a bit of light.
Right, for sore eyes. So when the postman comes, he's treated to this vision of Michael Parry in his football shorts and his Hawaiian shirt. You'd get down into this kind of cubicle, and there would be a hole in the ground, not joking, with a drain underneath it, and two sort of metal foot plates, one either side.
Oh,
and the idea was that you put your feet on the
Thank you very much.
That was common in Paris when I was a student there.
Well, it's never happened in where I've been to in Paris, but then again, like nice hotels.
And you only go to upmarket, posh places.
Certainly do, indeed. Bernard used to sit around all day doing nothing until afternoon conference and then start making all sorts of critical comments about the news list and all that kind of stuff. I used to hate him, and I used to make it absolutely clear I hated him, right?